Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, where I interview entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses. I've intentionally decided not to do heavy-handed economic and virus podcast episodes, even though I see that that's what leads to a lot of downloads. It's just not me. It just doesn't feel like the thing that the world needs another piece of. But I have noticed that when I see that some businesses are doing well, despite the difficult times, I feel that there's a sense of hope for my business, and it drives me to do better work. And so I went on Twitter and I said, hey, who's doing better? Who did better in March than they did before? And I got some answers. I got actually a lot of answers, frankly. March is when the coronavirus really became a big issue in the US, and the stock market took that big hit. And I got a bunch of responses. Many of them were in private DMs from people who said, I just don't feel comfortable saying this because I don't want to look like I'm bragging. And my response to them was, okay, I'm not going to allow you to do this because I don't want you to feel that there's any pressure from what I'm about to say. But you should know that when you tell people you're doing well, it actually doesn't, it's not bragging unless you do it in a braggy way. It's encouraging. And a little bit of encouragement, believe it or not, does help, especially when we've got so much discouragement coming at us everywhere. So one of those people is an old friend of mine, Curdy D, who said, hey, you know what? I'm working at a company right now that helps businesses hire, and they're doing well now. I'm going to try to like phrase things in a not so sensationalistic, excited, everything's going great way. But he said, look, the company is doing well. And so I said, would you please introduce me to your founder? And he said, sure. And he made the introduction and we made this interview happen. The person you're about to meet is Nick Kramitis. He is the founder of Hunt Club. It's a new category of talent company that leverages technology and expert networks to find your next hire. As you can probably guess, I totally just typed out exactly the way that he wanted me to describe the company. Oh, they've got an interesting way of finding people based on the people who are connected to them. I know that that seems a little bit ambiguous, so we'll describe it in a moment. But first, I should say this interview is sponsored by two phenomenal companies. The first will help you launch and grow your business. It's called HostGator. Host your website with them at hostgator.com/mixergy. And the second, if you're growing your business, if you're looking to get leads, you should check out ClickFunnels. I've been with them for a long time, and I highly recommend you check them out. Nick, first of all, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it, Andrew. Big fan.
Thank you. You help companies hire. Who's hiring when the market is so uncertain?
Yeah, there are a lot of different pockets acting in a lot of different ways right now. So I think the trend lines that we've seen, Andrew, is really companies that have just recently capitalized their businesses in the tech sector, so venture-backed, that still have critical leadership hires that sometimes take 45, 90, 180 days to actually get done. Like, they haven't slowed that process down at all. Some of them try to be pretty thoughtful about, you know, the timing and the cadence of like how the macro world impacts their business and should we pull the trigger on this hire right now? But I think most of the senior roles that we have not slowed down. We're actually seeing them accelerate because people know that they need to get these positions in place regardless of what happens in the next 3 to 6 months for it to be critical for their business. So I think companies that have had raised and closed rounds recently that are looking to accelerate their leadership teams, we're seeing quite a bit of still tech hiring. So companies that have closed financing that are looking to accelerate their product and dev teams to hit their roadmap requirements. And so I think, and those that have been insulated by either having a well-performing business over the years or a big enough war chest to go through and withstand some of the questions in the fog right now, we're seeing hold pretty strong. So it's,
you gave me a couple of examples that I thought were helpful before. The first one was you said telehealth companies. Do you have a couple of telehealth companies, more? How many? These are people who are doing what my doctor is going to be doing with me tomorrow. I had an appointment with the doctor to check out my lungs. And they said, well, you can't come in anymore, but why don't you just do it remote? And I said, you guys do it remote? That's pretty cool. I work with One Medical. They've been doing this forever. I didn't realize that UCSF here in San Francisco does it too. So telehealth companies are working with you. Are we talking about one, two, more?
Yeah, we have a couple right now. So we've got about three or four that we're partnering with to figure out how to get them great talent in this moment because their businesses are exploding. You know, everyone's okay. Coming to them. They've got more demand than they know what to do with. And so they're really having a bandwidth problem.
The other one I did a little bit of research on, not much, but from what I can tell, they are a cloud computing company that helps bigger businesses automate. And so I'm imagining they're expecting to grow because they're reducing costs through automation for enterprise.
Yeah, the whole robotic automation or workflow automation space is scaling like crazy, right? You look at like automation anywhere, I think it's the highest valued private company from a multiple perspective or something like that. So people that are playing in that space that help take certain tasks that you can either create more accuracy on or help reduce the amount of man hours on certain projects, we're seeing grow quite a bit in this moment.
You know, I have to tell you, one of the things that happened to me before this interview started was I got distracted. I wanted to see what Cuomo was doing, the governor of New York. And I started to then go down a mental rabbit hole. And thankfully, some alert went off and reminded me, no, stay back on focus and make sure you research Hunt Club. You go through that too?
Yeah, constantly.
Like, how do you bring your, what's your distraction? And then how do you bring yourself back to focus when you've got so many people counting on you?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's just being in the moment and understanding that you have to focus, right? And I think like it's just picking and prioritizing what you need to get done and focusing on that is kind of helping pass the moment as we're all figuring out how to get through this fog. So I think it's, you know, I'm a big believer when things are most, you know, ambiguous and we don't know where the direction is, like that's when you need to be sharpest in what your priorities are, sharpest in what the team's objectives are and maintain that focus and help cascade it to every part of the org. So I think it's just about in these moments where we don't know what's going to happen.
Can you be a little more vulnerable and a little more specific by giving me like an incident where you were distracted to and went to a bad place and what you did to bring yourself back?
Yeah, totally. So, so we're in the process of closing a round of financing for our business. And we've had a couple different parties at the table with term sheets. And over the course of the last week and a half, we've had one or two pull out. And so deeply distracting in the moment, and especially one group I was kind of excited to work with too as well. So, you know, I think this is causing a huge pause period. So we've got other parties at the table and other groups that we're excited to work with, but you know, it's been hard pivoting our kind of entire business strategy to some degree in the last 90 days. So that we can focusing on capturing this moment while making sure that our company, we're still small, we're about 80 people, but feel motivated and inspired and know that the work that we're doing as a leadership team will protect their futures and keep them active and excited and engaged. And I think also making sure that the strategy that we lined up is able to capture the moment in a way that will add value and create joy for our customers.
What do you mean by capture the moment?
Yeah. So a lot of our team on the recruiting side, like, is growing quite a bit and we're getting quite a bit of demand on the telehealth side, but there's still pockets where it is contracting and shrinking. So in those moments, what we're actually doing is repurposing them to focus on how can they help candidates that have gotten laid off figure out what's next? How can we use our unique expert model to help connect the dots with other mentors or other founders that have been through downturns to help our customers understand how to prepare and scenario plan?
Then are they going to pay you for this? Is this going to be a service that you start to offer? No.
Nope.
Completely. It's just you saying, look, we've got people here. Let's see if we can put them to work doing something. And we believe that in the long run, it's going to pay off.
Totally. And I think they're uniquely, given that most of our services team job is to take conversations like this all day, every day, they're uniquely equipped to actually prepare and consult people on how to handle and how to position themselves. So it's how do we create value and joy in a moment where, you know, a lot of people are scared and negative and or maybe a little pessimistic. And I think, you know, our team is creating a lot of good energy and the business is getting a lot of great inertia around the concept of like, let's do what we can in this moment where we can help and throw kind of the business model aside at the moment.
Okay. And so what about the impact on your business? If you're paying people to do work that doesn't pay now, what happens to your company?
Yeah. So great question. We're in the same position as everybody else where we're scenario planning and like upside, downside, mid case. So like what we've seen is our demand, although we're not necessarily acquiring as many customers net new at the moment, our existing customers that fit one of the profiles that I mentioned. So either in healthcare and we happen to do a lot in healthcare or in some sort of software that's an enabler from a cost perspective, aren't contracting that much of a demand perspective. So, you know, I think we're kind of in this fortunate position where like we're capitalized well enough. We have enough diversity from a customer perspective that, and we have enough, I think, fresh ideas from the team that, you know, in moments where there isn't a lot of work to be done, we're going to repurpose them to create awesome value for our candidates and customers. And then, you know, for other customer, for other folks on our team, they're full helping with searches and helping them land great talent.
So that brings me then back to your model. The reason you're able to help your candidates, the people that you've placed at jobs before, the people that you're hoping to place at jobs in the future, you're able to find them the right mentors is because you have a unique way of figuring out who's connected to whom and who could make the right introductions to the perfect person. And so I think the best way to explain that is to bring up something that I said to you before we got started, which is, if theoretically I were to be part of your network as what's the role that we talked about?
Expert.
As an expert. Okay, this is the way it works. The first thing that I would do is give you access to my Gmail account, not so you could read all my email, though I'd have to trust you not to read.
I would love to see what, no, I'm kidding. Yeah.
But what you want to do is see who does Andrew know? So if Andrew's an expert in, say, CEOs of tech companies, you want to know what through my Gmail? And what else would you need from me to, let's understand the model through using me as an example.
Yeah. So Andrew and Nick got to know each other. Andrew constantly helps people find jobs and opportunities or connects the dots as a super connector. So he signs up on Hunt Club. He drops his both an export of his LinkedIn contacts and his Gmail network. What our technology does is it looks at that network and then helps build a strength of relationship score based on how well does Andrew actually know Nick or other people in his network. And so when we have that kind of score articulated, what we do next is try and, when we have a customer that's looking for a great CEO, you know, let's just say it's a $1 billion tech company in the Valley. My gut says that Andrew knows quite a few people. So we'll build, using our tech, the list of candidates, the best 50, 70, 100 perfect bullseye matches for that role. And then we'll actually build a seamless way to push those suggestions out to Andrew so that he can really quickly say, yeah, I love Josh, but you know, Josh wouldn't be a great fit, but Susie's incredible and she'd be an awesome CEO.
But you wouldn't send me your whole list of ideal candidates. You would just check out my connections and say, you know what? It looks like Andrew knows these five people really well. Sure. He's been messaging with them. We don't know why. It might be that he's playing poker with them all the time. Might be that he's doing work with them. It might just be random back and forth, but we'll send it to him and he could figure out, do I know them well enough to make an introduction? And if I do know them well enough to make the introduction, I think you guys would then pay me as the expert for making the introduction and then pay me as an expert if you place that person that I introduce you to, right?
100% correct. And I think the really cool thing we do too is we give you a two-way chat with our services team so you can ask questions about the role, dig in, and make sure it's a great fit for your network. So, you know, we incentivize if your referral gets an interview. We incentivize if they get a job. You can donate that referral to charity. You can do whatever you want with it. It's our way of kind of paying it forward to those that are participating in our network.
Got it. That's the way that your model works. And so the same model could also say, you know what? We did place somebody at a high level of Dropbox, let's say. Mm-hmm. They are running a product at Dropbox, not the whole company, but they're leading, I don't know, what do they have, paper? Let's say they also have a pencil department too that they just launched. The person's leading it. They need to know how to launch it in a tough situation. You might say, well, one of our ideal people is, say, Eric Ries. He wrote the Lean Startup. He understands this. We don't know Eric Ries. Let's check Andrew's network. It turns out Andrew maybe emailed Eric five times a day for the last 2 years. We can ask Andrew, would you make an introduction to Eric? This is not a paid introduction, but it'll help somebody over here. He'll help everyone if you're willing to do it. Let's go for it, right? That's the model.
Exactly. It's going to be hard to get him onto the long-term stock exchange, but other than that, that's the model. We try and give Andrew the ability to help his network get great opportunities and roles and make it as seamless as possible for you to do that and reward you when it happens. And that's it.
The long-term stock exchange is his new thing that he's trying to create. I feel like he's doing that. And at the same time, on the side, trying to save the world. Every few days, every big crisis, I would say, Eric Ries is out there creating something. The latest one that was incredibly helpful, I wish I could remember the name of the site, but he created a site to help parents who have stay-at-home kids. And it was just a list of resources and a place to call other parents and stuff like that. And I found a great resource in there. There was this one app. I gotta get this freaking app. Anyone who has a kid, and if you have kids,
yeah, I've got a newborn though. So in this period, she's like 4 months old. So she's still, you put her in the baby bouncer for a bit, and I can get a couple hours of work done. But
really,
the parents in our company right now, it is this hard moment where they're trying to figure out how to balance life, work, and And I'm trying to do my best to figure out how to support them in this moment, but it's, you know, there's a total level of empathy and compassion for, you know, how hard it is to balance those things. And as a new dad for the first time, you know, you sort of have a totally different perspective on it. But hopefully it's making me a better founder and leader to the folks in our company, but it's not hard. It's probably the hardest challenge we have right now.
Yes.
Among everything else is how to keep our parents in our company in this moment, feeling positive, happy, sane, and still have enough emotional energy to like be able to contribute to their job on a daily basis.
Yeah, it's really hard when the kids keep asking you for attention when they're also going through their stress because they don't know what's going on. Why can't I play with my friends, right? For example, why can't I go outside and play in the playground? All that stuff. The app that he suggested, and I should get his site, it's called Together. It's great because my kid's grandmother can talk to my kids. They see each other's faces, talk to each other, and then they could bring up a book that my kid's reading and he can read it and show her and she can help him when he's stuck on words. She can read him the longer books. They could play games together like the memory game and Connect Four, probably like a knockoff of Connect Four. Let me see. Oh yeah, it's actually called Connect Four. So it's a bunch of different things like that. All right, let me take a moment to talk about my first sponsor and then we'll get back into the story. And I want to understand like how you came up with this. Yeah, there's this weird hole in your background that I can't understand.
Yeah.
All right. The first sponsor is a company called HostGator. Listen up. You see that there's a big problem going on right now. There are a lot of parents who don't know what the hell to... Can I say hell in an ad for HostGator? Probably not, but let's see. What the heck... Got to maintain my advertisers in a tough situation. You understand the parents don't know what the heck to do with their kids right now when the kids are at home. This is an incredible opportunity for someone who's saying, you know what? I want to get my mind off of things. I have a little bit of mental space, or I could use a project to give me something to focus on other than what's going on in the world around me. I'm going to put together a resource of how to teach your kids at home. Or I'm going to put together a different blog post on every little project that you can do for a kid. Pick an age group. 5-year-old to 6-year-olds, first graders, whatever it is, parents who are at home with babies, whatever it is, and then just research the heck. See, I'm watching myself. Research, thank you. Research the heck out of it. Find a couple of projects and make it the place to go for parents on a daily basis to find it. There's this author, Mo Willems. He's written a bunch of kid books. He is fantastic. Every day he's creating a new video on his website for kids to help them draw like him. And he'll talk to them. He'll tell them to hit pause and go draw. And so I'm watching my kid on the floor drawing it. He is using this as an opportunity to help families and connect with kids. I am now researching the heck out of more Mo Willems books that I can get. Now, is he doing this just for that? No. But it's a nice service for people, and there is a nice upside for him. If you're out there listening to me, whether it's this idea or anything else, help people right now. The fact that there's so many people who are in need means that there is an opportunity for you to create something. Don't worry about capitalizing on it. The benefits will come to you, but do see this as an opportunity for you to take your mind off what's going on around the world today. And instead of focusing on what's not working out, find a way to help things, to help people. This is what we as entrepreneurs always do. We look for pain in the world and we try to solve it. We try to address it. This world of pain that we're all in means that there's also opportunity. I'm going to say responsibility for entrepreneurs to jump in and help. Go to hostgator.com/mixergy. You'll get, you know what? I used to have to say, who cares? It's already a low price for hosting. It's going to be a few cents lower. Now we care, right? So go to hostgator.com/mixergy. And yes, you will get a super low price on already low hosting. HostGator, thank you so much for sponsoring. I said, heck, please keep sponsoring.
You caught that twice. It's great. You're going to maintain all sponsors. You're not losing one today. Not on my watch.
Right. Now, I can no longer say that I'm a New Yorker, even though I live in California, in San Francisco. Yeah, I call myself a New Yorker. By saying, heck, you're officially out. Cuomo will not allow you in. Forget Cuomo. No New Yorker will let you in. Heck. So look at this. I try to research you. Dude, you speak great, so there's no reason why you shouldn't be like out there talking much, but I don't see that much on you on the internet, though I think you've done a couple of interviews. I looked at your LinkedIn profile. I saw that you were before this just like a KPMG associate, and then suddenly like a year later, you became a venture capitalist, and then what was it? A year after that, you co-founded Hunt Club. Where does the money come from, for example, to jump from being an associate at KPMG to creating, what is this, New Coast Ventures, which invests in what you call the most entrepreneurial companies in the world? Where does the money come from?
So before you missed one spot, before the KPMG tour duty, I was a women's tennis coach at Northwestern University. So I graduated in 2009 at the height of, those issues in the economy. And next thing you know, like, I couldn't get a job. I wanted to be a strategy consultant. I didn't apply online, or I didn't go through like any of the on-campus recruiting. So I couldn't get a job. And what I was a professional tennis player for 1 week. And I played in college at Vanderbilt. So I had a skill. So I applied that to make some money in a period as Northwestern's women's coach. So it's important because that even makes the dots connect less. So I want to make sure.
Because now I'm even more confused because you did this for a little, you did this for about 10 months.
Coaching?
A women's coach, right?
Yeah.
And then it looks like there was also a big period of about a year with no work. Is that right?
Yeah.
You were just unemployed for a year.
Well, teaching, that's where the story actually begins. So that's where we should start. So I'll walk you through the career arc a bit. So I coached tennis for a year, and I did that. And while I was doing that, I had my CTO today, Scott, and my business partner across Nucleus and Home Club. Him and I were always building different software products. So he's a computer science guy from Vanderbilt, and he went over to Intuit and their software development program for a few years before I convinced him to move back to Chicago in the winter. Which was a hard feat, Andrew. But so I couldn't get a job in 2009. Like, I was begging and borrowing and stealing, trying to get anybody to help me get an interview that I could. So I ended up getting a job at Northwestern as the women's tennis coach, and I loved it. But during that period, Scott and I had this idea that we should be building software to help college athlete alums find other alums to talk to them about life after sports. And so Scott and I actually built a platform called Beth Lyons. We got two customers, Northwestern University, which wasn't that hard, and then Vanderbilt University, which, I was an athletic alum. They're paying us like some meaningless amount of money a month. It was like 25 or 50 bucks a month. But that was like the start and where I got the bug. So Scott and I built a product, visualized the product, launched it, and got two paying customers. And then I used that experience to convince KPMG to give an old tennis coach a job as an associate in their strategy tech practice. So it was kind of like a backwards way in where I was able to say, hey, I understand technology. I'm entrepreneurial. I've built something before. Like, I have some practical business experience, not just a good backhand volley. So give me a chance. So
let me just underline that. That is an unbelievable thing that we always overlook as entrepreneurs, that the fact that we created something, even if it didn't work out, does give us a set of skills and a set of... I was going to say a set of guts, but it shows that we've got some sense and guts, and it's valuable. And it's interesting to see that that's what got you into KPMG.
Yeah. So in a moment where no one was actually hiring all that much, I was able to finally get a job in consulting. But the problem with that was I caught the bug. I love the experience I had building what was called Athliance at the time.
Athliance?
Athliance.
Athliance.
You're good at the interwebs, Andrew, but you're not going to be able to find anything on that company, I don't think. It's unless you can go back into like the when we filed for whatever the LLC
was. It's not American Freedom Alliance.
No. There's nothing on the interwebs. It's been scrubbed. Right. No, I'm kidding. But built that business and got a job out of it, and then like got the bug from there. So at KPMG, I was there for about 2 years. Loved my team. Loved learning the work we were doing. Did a bunch of product development work and almost like staff augmentation for large companies that were building software products, and sort of got some baseline product management chops there. But always had a idea to want to go out and build something after. So, Scott, basically 2 years into KPMG, I convinced my co-founder Scott, who is at Intuit, living in San Diego, great apartment, like a block from the beach, like this awesome life where he was coding for 6 to 7 hours a day, but then surfing, and convinced him to move back to Chicago in February to build a photo sharing app called Motley with me, like 7 or 8 years ago. And so we thought it'd be a great idea to aggregate all of one's moments at a party, out doing something with friends or family at birthday parties into like one album. So basically albums, group photo feature.
Okay.
And that was like the kickstart of like most of this stuff. So we built one app, we scaled to the 30,000 users. We got to pitch everybody in the Valley, but no one wrote us a check. So we piggybacked that experience into getting have you ever heard of the Brandery in Cincinnati? Mm-hmm. It's an accelerator program there.
Okay.
So interesting accelerator program. They basically take a CPG focus where if you can build a great brand, you can distinguish yourself in a moment where a lot of tech companies are generally kind of the same and not really good at like differentiating. And so we use that experience to basically give us a platform to start Newcoast and then use that to start Hunt Club. So kind of where the money came from was I was really lucky that I had a couple friends from tennis and from kind of a different life in tennis. And that like were really excited about hearing all the buzz of Instagram getting acquired for $1 billion and what was really going on in the tech community. And then I'd spent the last 2 years building software, going through this program, pitching a lot of East and West Coast VCs and building a lot of great relationships. So in the moment, I just kind of asked, hey, we should consider investing in some of these companies. And do you want me to pick them? And would you support them? And that's how it started. And so the whole idea of Newcoast was, you know, we'd be a venture studio. We'd invest in 30 to 40 businesses, seed, series A, first round of financing, really entrepreneurial friendly, you know, having built and failed a business or two beforehand and getting to meet a lot of different folks. I felt there's a gap in the Midwest for those that could be founder first. And then through that landed on Hunt Club.
One of the companies that you invested in is HipCamp. I didn't realize they've been around for about 5 years.
Yeah, we invested in 2014.
Wow. I'm really looking forward to getting to use them this summer. It is such a pain to find camping sites. And especially now, I don't want to go to a hotel. I'm not in that mode. And I discovered camping last year and it turns out I actually like it and I'm not bad at it. So I want to do more of it, but it is hard to find campsites. It's not like I always thought you just have a tent and you just go pitch it wherever you want. Maybe it's because we're in the Bay Area, but you can't.
No, you can't.
No.
And her business, Alyssa, their CEO's business is fascinating. So she built her business based on the thesis that the essentially, I think it was in 14 for the first time, I think it was called the Open Land Act, were initially in order to win API access to put actual campgrounds and campsites on a website or an application, you actually had to bid with the government to get that listing or that access to that API. Obama opened it up and she's like, well, the people that are doing this have a terrible UI. Like, let me build a business based on like a better UI. And then she's done a remarkable job finding a new market and aggregating private land and these really cool, thoughtful locations that you'd never get to see if it wasn't for her applications or for her apps.
I didn't even realize that she was working on government land too. So when you were investing in a better search engine for government land to pitch a tent on?
Government campground.
Wow. To me, the exciting part is as I go through it, and you're right, the government campground searches online are just annoying.
It's actually a good business.
Is it? For the government?
Yeah. So Active, which is a big lease to equity backed business, like basically
Active.com?
Active Network. Okay. Had a monopoly on it. And, you know, we invested in that business based on Alyssa. Like her passion for the outdoors and bringing people together and the experience you can create is remarkable. So it was, once we heard about like a clever marketplace with a new kind of set of supply that most people weren't looking at, I was like, all right, like in. But it was a bet on her.
I wouldn't have thought. To me, the problem with San Francisco is that with hunting for things like campgrounds in San Francisco is a type A personalities. Dude, you should see the setups that people have to go and lock in the campgrounds months in advance because they're type A personalities. They lock everything months in advance and to outcompete everyone else, like especially people like me who are just dabblers and say, am I curious? Where do I want to go? Do I even care about this? It's painful. What I like about her site is that she also makes people's like, not backyards available, though I wouldn't be surprised if it was in there, but it's like random stuff. Like we have a winery, we have extra space, we have a porta potty because people use it during the day anyway. Feel free to come in here. Here's what we can offer you beyond the land and go with God, enjoy yourself. It's like, wow, I get to do that. That's all I'm looking for. It's not overcomplicated.
In a world of social distancing, being in open areas of land and getting to spend quality time with loved ones and friends and family, like is a great
opportunity. Think of that. That's going to be fantastic. Yeah. Now, I do have this almost shame about saying that's going to be fantastic about anything in such a tough environment, but that's something that I have to lose. We cannot get into a situation where we both want to stay above water and do well as a people. And then at the same time go, can't believe he's doing well or she's doing well. This is terrible, right? Like, why should you thrive right now?
It's a hard place to be, right? Yeah. I think it's those that are doing well feel bad about it. Those that are doing poorly feel bad about it. And it's like, it's just an odd psyche at the moment. But I think like it's
right.
You think I try and tell our team like positivity, like let's figure out how to help first, help our customers in any way we can, and figure out how to stay afloat and get through this in the best possible way. Work with customers that need us in this moment. And we even actually launched a really cool campaign, Andrew, where it's if your company is trying to help against anything regarding coronavirus, we're actually taking a portion of our search fee and donating it to a charity or to a group or a bar of their choice in this moment so that we can kind of help and do our part to combat it. So
that's another thing, by the way, that people are not comfortable talking about out loud. I've noticed that on Twitter, people are condemning companies that are doing well. Like, for example, companies are donating face masks. And I see people going, well, why are these guys hoarding face masks? And truthfully, I totally get it. I just don't get the anger towards it. Here's why I get it. A few days ago, my wife needed a drive into the office. I go, what, baby, why are you going in the office? She goes, do we have gloves? Do we have anything? I go, because we have, like, I wipe poopy diapers a lot. I needed gloves to wipe that goes with the diapers. So I have some of those. Those I didn't even think, can we donate? I think because of the way that we've kept them around the house, they're probably not appropriate to donate. But I did give it to Olivia. I say, if you're going into your office, at least cover up. She covers up. She goes in. She comes out with a box of face masks. I say, dude, what are you doing with all these face masks? How do you even have them? She said, the reason we drove her is because she needed a drive over to UCSF to just randomly pop in and donate them to the hospital. But I said, how are you guys at PagerDuty, which is a company she works for? How are you sitting on all this stuff? She said, do you remember the fires? I said, yeah. Well, in the fires, we wore face masks. Our 2-year-old at the time wore a face mask because the air was just so dirty. Apparently the local government required companies to have face masks because we're anticipating this is going to happen again and they need to protect their people. Well, OSHA in San Francisco recently said, if you have it, you're welcome to donate it. And so companies are going and donating it. Now, that's a lot to understand. It took me a while to understand that. It's natural to be curious. What's, I think, frustrating is that people's first impact or first impulse is to say, what the hell? How dare you hoard these things instead of, hey, what happened here?
Yeah, I think that when you hear the stories of people going out and like creating a surplus of hand sanitizer and selling it for a tremendous markup, and it's just, I think some of the bad actors in this environment have tainted anybody that just happened to have an abundance of something valuable in the moment. So I think it's like,
and those are unusual. By the way, is that your sound that's going off? You have these alerts going off? Oh, because we're so close to the end of our time together, aren't we?
No.
Do you have like an extra, can you go an extra 10 minutes beyond where we're supposed to go?
Yeah, of course.
Great. All right, then let me say this. My second sponsor is a company called ClickFunnels. Here's where I started to use ClickFunnels. I was buying ads and ads weren't working for me, but I still wanted to grow. And I said, you know what? Maybe it's not the ads. Maybe it's not that. Maybe it's what we do with people after they follow up on the ads. And so I signed up for ClickFunnels, to be honest with you, reluctantly. We created a landing page. A landing page actually got me more subscribers than my past thing. I said, huh. All right. I kind of dismissed them. Anyone could create a landing page. I could create one in HTML. I could create one in WordPress. What do I need a whole service for? And then I realized they kind of have all these different tools for what happens after somebody gives you an email address. And the first tool I did use was kind of basic. The next one was, hey, you know what? What if you charge somebody just a couple of bucks to get something? I said, well, we're not going to make much money from it. And someone on the team said, you know, you might actually be able to make enough money to pay for the ads. I said, I guess. All right, let's try it. And we sure enough, we were able to pay for our ads, not all of it, but a big amount of it. But then the thing we discovered was people who gave us their email address and then also paid even a couple of bucks ended up having a closer, tighter, more meaningful relationship with our company. Even if we lost money on them, which we didn't, I don't think, but even if we had, who cares? It's people who now have a tighter relationship with us than people who gave us their email address. Now, there are a bunch of little tools like that that you can add if you're using ClickFunnels. I know that I could test them, but who has the patience to go and figure this out? With ClickFunnels, they make it so easy to drag and drop a payment, drag and drop an upsell, drag and drop a one-click purchase that you say, all right, what the heck? What the heck? Look at me.
I like it.
Do you know San I've never Francisco, heard
the West Coast will embrace you. New York won't have you back because you didn't drop the H-bomb.
You know, that I've never heard anyone at ClickFunnels use anything saltier than the word heck. They're like super nice, smiley people. They never curse. And it didn't occur to me. I was on stage interviewing the founder. I cursed the whole time. because I got excited. I don't curse that much, but I got excited about what I was doing. I got excited about the people who I met at the audience. I got excited about the interview. And then at the end, they said, you know, you're actually in a city where people don't really curse much. We have this little idea, the videographer said to me, would you mind just talking and cursing? And we're going to like bleep it out. And then you look up at the sky and you go, where is this place that curses automatically get bleeped out or deleted? Where am I? And so I played along with them. And then I realized, oh man, Andrew, I get your enthusiasm, but read your audience a little bit better. If they're not cursing, don't hit them over the head with a curse every sentence. Just like, that's my problem. It's always been my problem. Over enthusiasm.
It's working really pretty well so far. So don't, I wouldn't pump the brakes on the curses if that's you.
And on the enthusiasm, I do. I do sometimes think, well, why are you enthusiastic right now? I should be proud that I'm enthusiastic and positive. I should be stoking that enthusiasm instead of feeling ashamed that I've got it. And with one exception, the kids are ready to sleep at night. I shouldn't say, hey, you know what? Let's wrestle. At that point, I should go, Andrew, calm down.
But you know, 7 a.m., 6 a.m. to 7:30, 8 p.m. fair game.
Right, exactly.
Stoke the flame. Go.
Let me close it out by saying, if you're curious about this whole ClickFunnels thing, if you want to try it out, I want to give you an opportunity to go and use it right now. If you go to clickfunnels.com/Mixergy, let me see. I think that they're actually going to give you clickfunnels.com/Mixergy. That's M-I-X-E-R-G-Y. They're going to let you use it. Look at this. They're going to let you use it for free. So go try it for free. If you like it, they will make you, they'll make sure that you make money, because frankly, you can see right away whether you're making money with it or not. And if you're not making money, cancel it. And if you're looking for a dose of inspiration, my interview with the founder of ClickFunnels, which is on that page, is fantastic. That dude failed and failed and failed. I went out and I got the screenshots of every freaking one of his failures. Like we're like, boom, 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 boom. I couldn't even get, since I use Pages, not PowerPoint, I couldn't even get the Pages app to like, my idea was drop all his failures on the screen, like one at a time. It was overloading the app, and I just couldn't make it work properly. But I said, all right, I'm going to glitch, even if it glitches out on stage, I'm going to do it. And so sure enough, it glitched out on stage, but there was like,
that sort of sets the point anyways, right? That's like kind of
so much that it freezes up Pages app.
Yes. It's almost right. A better story that way.
All right. So it is a good interview. Go check it out. ClickFunnels.com/Mixergy's got all that. So the ideas we talked about before we got started was the idea for Hunt Club, people started coming to you and asking you for what? And then you said, maybe I can do this a little more organized, more professionally.
Yeah. So the whole concept started, it was like the summer of 14, early 15. Basically, I have one friend that was a partner at a large executive recruiting firm. And he started winning a lot of these digital transformation, digital type searches. And he didn't really know much about them, but his customers had a need in the market for them. So he knew that I was in digital. Like that was the extent of our relationship. Usually we were just drinking beers and telling jokes. But you know, like he's like, oh, you're a digital tech guy, right? That's you. Who do you know that would be great for this? And so he'd get like a VP of performance marketing search or something like that, acquisition marketing. So he would look to see who I knew on LinkedIn and say, hey, can you introduce me to Bonnie or Sue or Tom? And I'd be like, sure. And I made introductions over and over again. And what I found out was I placed five people for him, you know, basically in a summer, in a 4 to 5 month period. And I kept getting emails back from the candidates that were in my network that I knew just through being around the community saying, hey, I actually took that job from that guy that you introduced me to. And thank you, because I never would have considered it unless it come from you, came from you. And it was one of those kind of aha moments where I was like, wait, our relationship made you turn away from what you were doing for a moment at your current job, listen actively and engaged with the recruiter and take a new job. Like, and granted, like that's a small part of it, right? Like it's the company, the opportunity, all these things, who they're reporting to. But like in a world where, you know, sometimes the best people are usually someone employed, not in today's world always, but in that world, like it usually requires trust. And I even think in today's world, like trust is what powers someone listening to an opportunity. Like I'm a co-founder and CEO of my own company. Like I'm not going anywhere, but there are still three people in my life that if they sat me down and said, hey, Nick, like you should consider this, I would listen. And that's just how the world works. So what we do is we power that at Hunt Club. So I spent a summer shadowing these firms, realized they have no technology that powers their end-to-end process, people that power every single component of their value chain and workflow. Recruiting.
You sat at his company and shadowed, yeah. Seriously, for a year, just sat at his office?
No, for a couple of weeks. Like I'd pop in for an hour or two a day for a couple of weeks, but I shadowed like the four largest executive recruiting firms in the world for this summer and like watched how they do work and watched.
I'm fascinated by this. I've noticed a few people who I interviewed have done that, but they tended to be, they tended to be younger people who are just above like the internship level. And so, you know, the older people felt, all right, come on in, take a look, sit down at the office. You're someone who's a little more advanced. I'd like to understand how you did this. Were you working on your own stuff while you were in there? What was the excuse that got you in there? How awkward was it for you to sit there? What did you notice?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think a lot of these recruiting firms are like pretty entrepreneurial environments where it's usually teams or pods of 3 to 5 people. Is how many of them operate. So it's not as awkward as it would be if I was joining like a marketing team for a summer trying to learn how to market SaaS software. So I basically called up and said, I want to build a business in this space. I'm fascinated about the lack of technology. I'm fascinated about the network effects that can happen. Can I just spend some time learning from you and learning how you do it and how you think about it and how you start a search for a customer all the way down to finding great talent and the steps that you take? And I was able to convince some friends to let me kind of ride coattail and learn a bit before we launched the business. But I think, Andrew, like the two insights that I found were, you know, one, there is no technology that powers these firms. Every single firm in their, you know, in any of their quarterly reports talks about how they're digitally enabling themselves and transforming their existing business. Like none are there yet or even remotely close. Like recruiting software is a decade behind sales and marketing software, at least.
Wait, don't they, from what I would imagine, they're using at least a CRM that is, are they using Salesforce? They're not using a custom CRM?
They use many of them use basically a Salesforce database on top of their own UI. But I think the really interesting thing is most of them, their first move isn't to use their proprietary network or coveted Rolodex that they all claim. It's actually to go to LinkedIn like the rest of the world. So I think it's a pretty hilarious paradigm that it's you're paying these massive firms for their Rolodex and their network, but they're using the same kind of tools and systems as the rest of the world.
So they would go, they would get a new client. I imagine they would start with their own CRM. No,
so they get a new client, then they have an associate on their team who's junior. Oh, sorry about that again.
What is that? I'm curious about people who have alerts go off during the day. What is that?
That was my iPad telling me that I had a meeting in.
And you're okay with going a little longer?
Yes, we can
thank
go
you.
Long.
Okay.
Yeah, we're good. We're good. So basically, they start a search. They'll have an associate team research and build a list of candidates, the best 150 candidates for the position. That will take them anywhere between 4 to 8 weeks. Once they've identified those best 150 candidates and 400.
And sorry, and that's them researching like in all, lots of different places. There's somebody
LinkedIn,
who.
Data, but their own databases, calling
Googling?
People, asking who's good,
calling.
Googling,
okay.
Like really kind of doing a ton of research in the marketplace, but primarily using either their own network or asking about other people's networks.
Okay.
So after 4 to 8 weeks of doing this process, they land on a list of people that they think are great. Then they start reaching out to them and asking, are they interested in the opportunity? If they're not, who do they know that's a great fit? And that is how every single one of these marquee firms function. Like it's they try and go directly to their own network first, but in the event that they can't solve the problem there or find someone great, they immediately just start asking for referrals and different network effects. And so what I learned was like, there's no technology powering these processes. We're not automating research yet. They're not even close to it. They're basically using a leveraged service model where they have associates who report to engagement managers, who report to principals, who report to partners, really expensive, nice, big offices. Like it's just, so my whole thought process was, what if we built as much technology as we can today in the future to automate the process, scheduling and things like that. And then automation of who's a great fit, and then use the same world-class network that they built on their own, just powered their own platform. So if we're doing a CMO search, we can have the same CMOs who know this person, who this person trusts, say, hey, take a look at this and have a conversation. And so that's the power of HuntCloud.
And I would have thought that the harder part would be to put that list of 100 or so people who are potential candidates. What you ended up doing was solving the, once we find a candidate, how do we get the right introduction? What did you do about that first part?
The hardest part is not figuring out who the right fit is, right? So like you could probably spend a couple minutes building a framework on if this is a Series B consumer company selling razors, what type of talent will be a great fit based on where their growth trajectory is and what the current marketing organization looks like and what the product is and what their location is, right? That's not the hard part. The hardest part about recruiting in any capacity is getting someone who's an awesome fit for the role to actively engage with you and listen. And what we believe in a world where like there's more noise than anything else out there today between email, you know, social media, cold calling, like everyone has access to your personal information. The only thing that continues to play in the future is trust. So like what we're really trying to do at Hunt Club is power trust. So when a candidate is introduced to an opportunity, it comes from someone that switches their head from being passive to at least actively engaged with our team. And it's, they're not always the right fit. They may be looking for a bigger job, bigger compensation threshold. They won't move to Chicago. They won't move to San Francisco, whatever it is. But we're getting them in a moment to actually actively listen because it comes from a trusted source. And that is the hardest part of recruiting.
And how did you know that that was the hardest part?
Yeah, well, you watch these incredible recruiters work. Like most of them build and cultivate networks for decades. Like decades. And then what they do is they'll be an executive. Like it's like, are you familiar with Egon Zehnder?
No.
So they're one of there's four major firms basically in the space, but they're one of them. And it's really interesting. Most of the people that work there actually never come from recruiting. They spend a career in a function in an industry and then join the firm because they've built a great network.
Oh, because they built a network in that. Got
it. And an expertise. Yeah. That was sort of the initial inspiration for the model is if they can go out and build a world-class recruiting company that's one of the biggest in the space, sort of rescaling a profile person that's never been in it because of the density of their own network effects, and like, why don't we go out and hire people that have never really been and worked in recruiting but are awesome at customer service and client service and arm them with the same network as the best executive recruiter because of trusted referrals.
And then how do you get your clients?
Right now, it's actually referrals, believe it or not. So as our experts refer candidates that have a great experience and get an interview or a job, many of them, over 80% of them are hiring managers. So they come back to us and say, actually, I have a couple things on my team. Can you help us? And then as our candidates have a great experience, many of them actually come back and be customers. So as it sits right now, we're about an 80-person company. We haven't had a sales or marketing organization really up until 3 or 4 months ago. That's where we got Curdy D now running their West Coast. But the whole idea is, you know, we'll build out brand awareness in local markets. We'll try and create events, try and connect people authentically to add value. And then through those connections, it just plays really nice with our brand guidelines of helping each other and ultimately paying it forward. And I think at the end of the day, when you work with somebody in recruiting, you want someone that you trust has an awesome network and get great talent to take you seriously, but also will be there for you as a customer. And we're really trying to solve both those.
What was your revenue last year?
We are a mid 8-figure business, Andrew.
Wow.
Yeah.
We're talking in the tens of millions.
Sorry, low 8-figure business.
Okay.
Why
am I like blanking out on what this is? 7 figures means a million, right?
7 figures means a million. Yeah,
so
no,
over 10 million.
I misspoke. We're a low 8-figure business.
Okay. So over 10 million.
Sure.
Okay. And that's your own personal cut from commissions? That's what you get paid for placing the candidate.
Yeah, so we get paid a fee. We call it a pay it forward reward. So like if you think about the world as it exists today, it's usually a retainer at the highest level. So you pay somebody regardless if they place the role. We actually do a shared risk model, so you pay a start fee and a success fee. So a little bit upfront and the lion's share of it once someone's actually successful. And we love that model because when I was watching our portfolio hire up and sign these retained firms, there's no more painful check in the world than when a Series A or B company or C company like pays $150,000, $200,000 for a firm that doesn't actually deliver value on the back end. So we do a shared risk model and we think it aligns way more nicely with our customer base.
All right, let me close it out with this question that I've been asking a lot of entrepreneurs now in my interviews, which is, what What's your plan for a recession? For if there's a recession, how do you handle it? And obviously, I know things are going to change and we can't predict it, but what are you thinking now you could do to be recession-proof?
Yeah. So I think in moments of where people stop hiring full-time workers, they do hire contractors to help in different areas. So we're really thinking about how do we kind of take this unique operating model of connecting experts to people for things, empower that in all different types of work and help. So whether it's I need a 3-month contractor project for performance marketer, or I need a product manager to help me build a great roadmap, or I need a fractional executive to help mentor my young VP into becoming a CEO. So we'll power all the different types of work, and we've already started doing some of that already.
Got it. You're saying, look, I got a model to help connect people. Where do we need it? Where do people really struggle to get to connect to people? And what's the highest value? So we're not looking to connect you to a new friend to play Minecraft with, but we're looking to think what's the high value connections that our software, our platform can work on. All right. Exactly. Kurti D is Kurt Deredix. You know what? I was actually looking him up right now to realize, you know what? I called him Kurti D in the intro. Is it okay? Is this like an old friend of mine? I've known him for over a decade. I'm calling that. Did I just like use his personal nickname? And I'm glad to hear that you used it too.
It's you Kurt dropped Deredix. A couple emails early on with the sign off as Kurti D, so we're all good.
I always, as a kid, my name was Shuki. I hated it. I changed it to Andrew. I was dying to have like a cool nickname like Kurti D that just sticks with you, that sounds rhyming. Anyway, so I can understand why he would want to keep it.
My name is not that interesting either. Nick Kermitis, last name can kind of sound like a disease, so I get it, man.
That's a really tough one. All right. Thank you, Kurt. Thank you. It's the website. It took me a while. I kept Googling you guys. Then, because for some reason, I didn't think you'd have huntclub.com. I don't know why, but you do. The website for anyone who wants to go check it out is huntclub.com. I talked about Eric Reese's website. It is schoolclosures.org. So if you're a parent, you're looking for resources, he's got it up on there. And I want to thank the two sponsors who made this conversation happen. Thank you so much to HostGator. If you're hosting a website, hostgator.com/Mixergy. Frankly, it gives me credit for introducing you to them. And if you're creating a landing page, if you're trying to create strangers or take strangers and turn them into customers, check out clickfunnels.com/Mixergy. And of course, it's a follow-up interview. The interview with the founder is fantastic. It's also available at clickfunnels.com/Mixergy. Still promoting, still here. Heck yeah, man. Thanks so much for being on here. Thank you, Nick.
Appreciate it, Andrew. Thanks again.
You bet. Bye.